Hello and welcome to The Big Interview with me, Robert Bound, where today my guest is the film producer Tessa Ross. Ross is famous as one of the definitive taste-making voices in world film, where, as head of Film 4, she lit the blue touch paper on world-beating, much-loved, commercially successful and critically acclaimed modern classics. 12 Years a Slave, Slumdog Millionaire, Under the Skin, to name but a few Oscar botherers. Ross has also had stints as the head of the UK's National Theatre and as a literary agent. She lives and breathes stories, it seems. And it's sort of all been change for the film executive recently. Ross has left Film 4 to start her own film production company with Juliet Howell and now finds herself on the other side of the commissioner's desk. So how does that feel? We'll find out that and how a pro reads a script and finds gold between the double space type. And Tessa Ross joins me now. You've made some of my favourite films of all time, and also, of course, some of everyone's favourite films of all time. I want to list Slumdog Millionaire, Under the Skin, 12 Years a Slave. These are the big ones. But you also made Robinson in Ruins back in the day, which is one of my very favourite things. People maybe will be Googling that while we speak. But I wanted to ask you, referring to those big films, do you have a sense of the scale of something when it flops onto your desk as a piece of paper?
Firstly, I want to say one thing to that, which is I didn't make any of those films. And so it's very nice when you say that, but I was part of those films.
Okay.
So I always slightly tense when people say, you made, and I think, no, you know, I was part of a very big team, yeah. And I enabled other much cleverer people than me to make those films. So
I thought you might say that.
Yeah, good. Well, but I think it's important because I think otherwise you tend to go around sort of taking credit in a weird way for the bits of your life that worked and the bits that didn't become other people's faults.
Okay.
And the truth is you sort of join a band or you enable a band or you enable a team of people to come together. And the answer to your question is no. You probably do get a tingle that something could be special. But of course, things are as good as the people who then come in to write, to direct, to produce. And all of those people grow. If that thing of raising the roof on something, how do you keep lifting the possibilities of a project? And so when somebody told me, in fact, it was the woman who I'm now in a brilliant partnership with running my new company, House, Juliet Howell, who was my head of development at Film 4. And she rang me, I was at the Cannes Film Festival, and she rang me on the phone and said, we've just had this submission of a book proposal called Q&A. And she told me the idea and I went, yes, get it. And we went through then quite a long process of trying to option the book, but the idea definitely gave me a tingle.
And it's that thing, I suppose, possibilities that endlessly flow from these sort of nuggets of ideas. I suppose these are the mighty oaks from these tiny acorns. But wonder how things are presented to you. You're now co-directors of a new company with your old development director at Film 4. What stuff does come across your desk? Is it sort of back of napkins? Is it rushes? Is it scripts? How do you see things first?
It's such a different thing that the sort of energy of running a production company and chasing everything and working in public service, which I was doing at Film 4 or when I was head of drama at Channel 4 or when I was at the BBC or any of those jobs where you're job is to make it as wide open a door as possible for people to come to you. Actually, the answer to that is in any which way that you can get the best stuff in the door. And not everybody puts things in a lovely format, which is called a treatment or, you know, what you want are clever people feeling welcome. So in what way can you make them welcome? And the answer is not in a format, is my view of that. I've never had, I don't think, something written on a napkin.
It's probably the journalist's desire to make a romantic story of a pitch.
But those pitches tend to be with people.
Yeah.
And it tends to be the people that you believe. So it's, you know, the idea and the person is usually the combination which allows you to go, I can see that in my mind's eye. I believe this person knows why they want to tell this story and how they want to tell this story, and I want to be part of helping them. And that's a really exciting feeling. And now what I'm doing is I'm chasing people differently. I'm getting books and scripts and people coming into meetings and talking, but I'm asking to be the most attractive production company to support their work rather than saying, I run this lovely big public service fund or, you know, commissioning structure to enable them to make their work.
So you're not quite on the other side of the fence as you were before when you were at Film 4.
No, I think it would be fair to say that my overview is far greater working in an institution than it is building a little tiny acorn that I hope will grow into a mighty oak now. So in a way, the building is of the company as well as of the projects. How do you do both at the same time?
And at House, you're going to be involved in TV and film production.
Yes.
What's the balance of power like on that sort of seesaw between those two mediums at the moment? We're told that TV's been so much in the ascendancy as a medium in the last 5 years. Where do you rate it?
The most important thing is that you have to love both forms. So you have to do the thing of saying, I'm so thrilled that this might work for television, not because what television has done, I think, in its massive growth, I mean, this fantastic mushrooming of talent thinking that they have the freedom in television that they don't have in film, has meant that, from a business point of view, it's meant that companies have thought, great, there's a pipeline, there's a hungry pipeline called television, and I can feed it, and that will allow me to survive. Because, of course, film has traditionally not been a particularly satisfactory business, particularly in the UK. There is an appetite. There are, you know, 50 companies buying television from however many hundreds of independent production companies there are out there. So there is a pipe that's hungry to buy what you're making. That isn't the way film is made. Nobody's saying, I've got to have them.
Yeah.
You have to will the film up the hill.
Yeah.
So that difference of making television is more that once your first episode is written and you know how you want to make it and the budget has been agreed, instead of it being that first hour, it'll be six of them. And if it's a really good returning series, it'll be another six. What I'm saying about that, I think, is that you have to want to do it because it is the greatest possible version of that story rather than it is the most financially viable version for your company.
Yeah.
But I think that's the right way, because actually then what you're saying is, I'm only interested in television or film if it does something nobody else has done before. I'm not interested personally in derivative. I'm not interested in doing things like Before.
Yeah.
Where the market will decide for me what's going to work. Actually, what I'm interested in is things built from the inside of people's guts rather than on the outside, where marketing or demographics or something else will make a decision.
I was going to say, so many of the films that you have had, you know, that have your name attached to them, they are so different and disparate. I mean, they're all amazing stories, sort of bulletproof stories, like Beatles melodies. You know, anyone can cover them and make them sound great, kind of thing. But you don't have seem to have something that you always like to do. Am I wrong? I don't know whether you've ever been asked that before or whether you know that there is always one element, one tenet of something that you like to see repeated or like to see.
No, I think you're right. And I think as a commissioner, I treated producers as part of the talent package.
Yeah.
And so when I talk to producers who say, well, no, this is mine as much as it is this director's, this writer's, I'm interested in that sense of self in the process where you have an ego and you bring it as a producer to the process, whereas I'm interested in the opposite of that.
Yeah.
How do I not have an ego? How do I understand what is being described to me and then make it possible? So it's actually, how do I become in tune with the people who are making, you know, writing, directing, delivering? So the idea that you would have a style, you might have taste, but your taste can be as broad as possible. It can be just, what I have is very good. Obviously, I think we all do. I have very good taste. I recognise talented people, and what I want to do is get the best out of them. So I would say, I love things where I go, they had to be made now.
Right.
That doesn't mean they have to be set now. But I like the idea that there's an urgency to the person in that story being supported now.
So there's something of the cultural moment there, something of what the world actually does need is a movie like this at this point in time. Because these things flourish and blossom and become part of the culture at that point when they might not have been a success 10 years ago or 10 years past. There is something about that. Is that just pure serendipity? Or is that a bit of that and tons of amazingly good management behind the scenes and talent and things?
I think it's so bound by not just the role that I've played.
Yeah.
If you think about films that work or programs that work, they work not just because they're good. They work because they're released on the right day, with the right support, without the wrong or right competition, with a sense of what's going on in the world. In a way, timing and the kind of commitment of a distributor or a marketing team or an understanding group of journalists who respond to the piece at the same time in the same way, all those things start to feed whatever becomes the eruption that is a cultural moment.
Yeah.
I honestly think that if I have any instinct, it's for the quality of the people I work with. I'm not sure that I could say, well, I know, I understand the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
But somebody like Alex Garland, I trust that he does. Or Danny Boyle, I trust that he does. Or Andrea Arnold, I trust that she does. So what you're doing is you're responding, I think, to the brains you admire.
When you're meeting with these directors and writers and producers, do you have a sense of they're reading the tea leaves of the world around them in a way, or maybe they're just focusing on a very specific story, but making it a story that everybody can appreciate? You're sort of reading their tea leaves, aren't you? You're sort of sifting the story from the talent in a way, are you, I wonder?
Yeah, that makes, again, it sound like I'm doing something cleverer.
I'm not trying to make you sound like some sort of magus here, you know, the puppet master, Tessa Ross.
Yeah. I feel that if you say, look, I've got a lovely sofa and I've got a cup of tea and what I'm interested in is what you think.
Yeah.
then actually in that conversation, in the way that we're having one now, you start to believe people, understand where they come from. Mm. You've loved their work, or you've read something or watched something. You've started to engage with how they work before they've sat on that sofa. And then you're able to say, look, my instinct is that you should lean more towards that part of the conversation rather than the other part of the conversation. Mm. And then you start to shape the possibility with them because of how you've engaged with them personally. And that seems to me a really both instinctive and honest way of working.
Yeah.
That what you're doing is you're trying to actually understand the person. You're not trying to say, look, I'd like something in this shape, in this form, about this. Of course, the zeitgeist is now all about how robots are going to take over the world.
Yeah.
So if you could think in those terms, I'd very much like it if it could be 8 hours for Netflix.
Yeah.
I mean, I might as well write it myself.
Yeah.
And what I always feel is, maybe I could, but there are people who are so much better.
I wonder what you watched growing up, and I wonder what it was like when you were suddenly making these shows and working on these shows and or working for a broadcaster rather than just sitting down on the sofa with your cup of tea.
Well, I was a theatre mad buff.
Yeah.
So I used to go every night, literally every night, to the theatre. And I had a brother who was a film obsessive. So between us, we'd either seen everything that was on or watched yeah. everything that was on. And I used to watch him, you know, repeating Scorsese lines over and over and over again. You know, he was Robert De Niro at home. And he'd watch me dreaming that I, you know, could be Peter Hall and,
yeah.
you know, whatever it was. And actually, for me, it was about, it wasn't any one moment of a different form. And I've always found that really interesting in this country and have been proved both right and wrong in my desire to sort of break down the barriers between those things, that it seems to me that culturally, these things aren't that different. I mean, that actually, in the end, has proved not to be true, but that film and television shouldn't be different.
Mm.
That what you're doing is you're talking to a writer, you're asking them to tell their story, and then you're saying, what is the best version of this story and yeah. how can I support it?
Yeah.
In any event, that thing of why you choose to go into a certain medium is about where you can have the greatest effect, I think, for the people you care about. For me, it was, where do I have the greatest effect for what I care about? So I worked in the theatre. I went to Bristol Old Vic, where I trained as a director.
Yeah.
And I thought, at a quite an early point, do you know, I'm not having the effect I want. I'm not directing the new work. I'm not related to new writing. Is this the right thing? I'm in Harrogate. I'm directing, or assistant directing, the Railway Children. Is this really going to change
yeah.
anything? And the answer was no, it wasn't going to change anything. And I wasn't earning enough money to visit a friend of mine who was ill in London. And I thought, this is silly.
Yeah.
You know, where are my priorities? How do I change them? So I then left to become it taught me a lot, a literary agent, where my job was to find talent to represent and to develop their careers and make the best possible deals for them. And I was probably pretty good at spotting their work and really was not that interested in how to negotiate better deals for
yeah.
them. You know, I spent time on the floor looking at their scripts much more than I did on the phone negotiating their contracts, and so quickly realised I had to move into something else.
But it's all about stories. All of this stuff is about stories.
Yes.
Also, you mentioned Peter. I mean, in terms of directing, you mentioned Peter Hall. I mean, you're going to cringe about this, but I mean, he was an impresario. In many ways, you are doing that thing of tying up so many things, introducing talent to talent, managing all these things and expectations. There is a hint of the impresario about Tessa Ross, right? Come
well,
on.
Well, that's very nice. I don't know that I actually dare think like that because of my recent past. But, yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that he was also a theatre director.
Yeah.
And I wasn't. I mean, I loved it. I enjoyed it. I loved sitting in a rehearsal room or working in a rehearsal room with actors. But actually what was exciting for me was talking about the story.
Yeah.
And that became something I could do almost more immediately with a writer. And that's why I went into script editing and then yeah. into commissioning.
Yeah. When you were talking about your time as a literary agent as well.
Yeah.
I was kind of thinking, when I speak to a friend of mine who's an editor at Faber, and you know, you guys always have, you know, you have first dibs on all the best stories. They might be the most famous stories in next year or in 5 years or yeah. in 10 years' time, but that you're kind of drilling down into the magma of the world's stories.
Yeah.
Do you feel in a privileged position every time something, even if it's not something that will be made, comes across your desk these days? You still have that excitement for
yes, them. I do. I absolutely love it. So the projects that I can now look at a slate of, you know, say 45 or 50 projects and go, you know, some of these are going to happen. And we're even more closely bound in to the fact that they will and that they may make a difference to the people who make them, to the culture that we're part of, to the stories that are being told. to the way film is delivered or television is delivered, all of that may make a difference. And actually, you want to have a good effect on the world, don't you? Otherwise, yeah, I'm not quite sure what the point is.
But it's tricky. I mean, it's complicated stuff, right? I mean, there is the purity of the story.
Yes.
But let's not pretend for a second that your role has been easy. I mean, there is so many things to juggle and balance.
Yes.
Do you have rules for that? Do you find yourself working in ways that you weren't 10 years ago that leads to greater success, I wonder?
I mean, I think that's a really interesting question, and I'm not sure whether I have this very idealistic view of things, whether that is maintainable, and in a way that's the test of the company, whether or not you can have a commercial enterprise that allows you to be the best you can be with the kind of integrity and generosity that you want to maintain. I really don't know the answer to that. It's a competitive, horrible world. And despite the fact that all of my instincts are towards sharing and giving away, I've now got to hold on to things and do them for myself or for my company. And that's an interesting, not conflict, but change of muscle, if you like. And that means that I'm competing with people I've spent a lot of time supporting. You have to believe that you want to sleep well at night, at all the very boring cliches about how we all work. I also think that you have to be absolutely driven to protect something happening in the right way. And if you're doing it for somebody else, I think you can do it. I would fight till the ends of the earth for things I believed in or people I believed in. Really hard to do it for your own status. Really hard to do it for your own credit. I've always found those things quite ugly.
Maybe
when people say, well, I'm going to be the first credited producer, or I'm going to earn more money than you, and I think, okay, fine. My instinct on those things is, that isn't the battle I'm interested in having, but put me in front of somebody to protect a director's cut or the right casting for a film or the way the film should be financed or the way it should be distributed, I will fight till the end, because then it's about something else and somebody else, and I'm really happy to do that.
And I'm thinking, as you're saying that, of Under the Skin, the amazing Jonathan Glazer film starring Scarlett Johansson as an alien, one of the most affecting films for years and years, 25 years, if not more, amazing thing. And the extras on the DVD are fantastic. I mean, they're a work of art in themselves.
Yes.
And this, I very much felt that I was being allowed into the studio somehow, or into the filmmaking process. Such was the wit and talent of the talking heads, the production designer, the director, all the different people involved in it. What was the process of that? Such a fearsomely singular vision, it seemed to me, from Jonathan Glazer, to give people a sense of the bumps in the road that a film like that with such a singular vision has to go over. Were there any moments where you had to pick up the phone and beg for his integrity to stay intact on something like that?
I mean, it was a really interesting process, because when I got to Film 4, it already existed, but it existed in a very different form. And Jonathan worked with more than one writer on that project and in more than one shape of story. I don't know if you know the original novel. It's a very different story. It has a lot more plot and more characters, actually.
Yeah.
And what we've ended up with, or what Jonathan ended up with is a beautifully almost unspoken film with a soundtrack that almost told the same story itself in a whole other way. And so that was a process that took 13 years. And I can say that more than once my chief executive would say to me, you shouldn't be going on with this one. You're putting more money behind a project that isn't happening. And I'd go, but I believe him. And so when you're fighting to protect something that may not happen, you have to know what your job is, I think. And my job there was to make sure that John Glazer made his next film, and he could only see this as his next film. So the question was the right form of making it. And it went from being a story about two characters to a story about this one who actually was enabled by a process of budgeting, actually, that he had a $45 million film that he could see no way of financing, that was almost on the edge of being financed if. And in the end, I think I turned to Jim and his producer and him and said, I think we have to look at, you know, the cheapest possible version of this film. What would that be? And that ended up being about this singular character. And although, you know, so you're saying, well, I might have been a part of the catalyst that allowed him to make the right version of the film.
Yeah.
And that was a process of many years of him getting to know me and me getting to know him and him trusting me, as opposed to thinking I was just a suit in an office. You know, all of those things that start to lead to a way of making the film. And actually, John's way of working is to keep asking the question until the very, very, very end, which means it could go on for an incredibly long time, and that every commercial that he made and everything that he shot was another way of him testing the possibilities of what he could do with this film, because it was an obsession for him to make this film.
Yeah, and it seems like that in a very good way.
Wonderful.
when you watch it. But it just seemed to me that possibly a standard setter for how a tricky idea, but how something goes through loads of changes, and that is something that you had to manage and that he had to manage and that all the people that worked on that project had to manage.
Yes.
It seemed like possibly a career in micro, you know.
But microcosm. I think if you say, I am going to make this film, trust me, we're going to find a way of my job was to find the way. And in the same way that, for example, the job is to say to people, you'll make your next film. In a way, it's about it not being your last. So that constancy of saying, look, I'm here and I'm going to keep on backing you because I believe in you. So let's keep going. Let's not worry. And that gives you the right to challenge somebody, I think. That gives you the right in that safer space to say, look, I've said we're going to make it. Now let's have the conversation about what's wrong.
Yeah.
Somehow that's all right then.
Yeah.
Or when I said, Lenny Abramson was about to make a film called Frank. We'd made a film called Garage with him. He made Frank. And I said to him, look, the important thing is, I promise you we'll make your next film.
Yeah.
You know, make this film. It's wonderful. I promise you we'll make the next one. And so it's that. It's believing people and believing that your job is to see a career through, not just the pick and mix of the films you want that year. But in the end, we spend our lives with these bubbles in our head going, I'm not good enough. I'm not tall enough. I'm not clever. I'm too old. I want to be other. I want to be better. And that bubble needs to be somehow taken away, doesn't it? Or reduced a little bit so that you're saying to somebody, okay, so you worry about what you had for breakfast. Now don't worry about the work. Let's just make it work.
Yeah.
My job is to make this person as happy as possible to deliver the best version of what they can deliver. And that's often about taking the stress away.
Before we switched on the microphones, when we were chatting before we came into the studio, in fact, we were talking about the idea of good taste. Is it down to that? Is that the kind of the mother load of this whole thing? Is just simply having taste, knowing what stands, if not being able to pick a winner every time you go to the races, being able to have an idea of what people will like, how a thing should be made?
I think that's a wonderful general way of describing it, because I actually think it's about the freedom to take risks. So it's how do you create the environment where it being wrong is as okay as it being right? And the idea that we all go around talking about just our successes and not our failures is a terrible, terrible problem. Because in order to make the films that you very kindly say, look, you've Slumdog and 12 Years and, you know, Under the Skin or Shane Meadows or whatever, they're fantastic, wonderful, I can list them. And there are other things that didn't work. The things that didn't work taught me how to make the things that did. So in a world where you're allowed mistakes, I think you can start to understand taste. And that's where control always worries me, where if you tell people who can direct your television and who can be cast in your television, you know, who can write your television, well, how are people going to start to judge for themselves what works and what doesn't and why it works and why it doesn't work? And that's a big ask of broadcasters or anybody financing something to say, look, actually what you've got to do is be prepared to lose, because that will allow your winning to be greater. But the edges of our work are where the greatest hits happen, but that means the worst failures as well. You can't have one without the other. The point, I suppose, is people have to have the confidence to articulate their real opinions, not their received opinions. And that's what allows you to produce, commission, direct, right, the more you're able to articulate what you really feel, it's like, what do you really want? What do you really love? Then actually you start to articulate your taste.
Your sort of standard is, tell me what you really think. Have you prettied it up because you think I'm going to like it? There is a bit of an analyst couch element to perhaps your job over the years, right? Actually, tell me what the story you really want to write. I don't know whether this is the thing. I don't know whether this is the film you want to make. Have you done that?
I have done that, and I've done the thing of asking the question, is this the best version of what you want to say? And if it isn't, then there's time. That this pressure of delivery and structure and timing, so long as this is the version you can now go out and face your critics with, that's fine. So long as we've asked every single question, that's fine.
You have to be critic one, I suppose, for people.
Yes, but I think you can only do that if you're on somebody's side and you've understood where you were going in the first place.
Yeah, it's like family, right? You can only...
Yeah, well, that's a nice way of describing it, but I think it is like that, where you say to a John Glazer, is this what you meant?
Yeah.
And if it is, then it's fine. Then you can stand by him and he can stand up tall. And when a critic doesn't get it, you know, when he went to Venice and it wasn't as beloved as it should have been, he was confused, but he could stand by his film.
What's your favourite bit of it? Is it the wump of something with potential on your desk? Is it the awards? Is it simply the sofa and the cup of tea? Is it meeting up with the likes of John Glazer, as you mentioned, who must be a big part of your professional life as well with that film? What's the best bit?
I think the best bit of having done a lot of work that people recognise as quality work is that you're allowed to pick up the phone to the clever people you admire and you don't know and say, I have an idea and I wonder if you'd like to talk about it. I've always thought that you should maybe think about this. What do you feel about that? That somehow the doors open, and that opening that possible conversation with the next discovery, that is a really brilliant bit. And then the other thing I absolutely love is finding people I've never heard of. Baby writers or directors whose work I suddenly feel is thrilling, and thinking, well, in 5 years' time.
Yeah.
And I do love that feeling, that you're looking at a future. But it's not necessarily about age, but it is about discovery.
And is it a shiver up the back of the spine? Is it laughing out loud at a joke in a script? I mean, this is when you know something's working, right?
I'm just trying to think of a recent example. So Alice Birch sent me her script of a play that she's putting on at the Royal Court. And it's absolutely wonderful. And I knew that Alice Birch was a very talented writer, but this is a most fantastic piece of playwriting. I'm very excited that we're working with her. I'm very excited to know her. I'm very excited that she's that clever.
And do you feel like that you've kind of... There is an element of taking people under your wing. You know, we're at Film 4, where now you're running house, that you're nurturing, you're protecting. There is a bit of that. There must be a teensy bit of knowing you're good, of the ego, of knowing that you're good, in order to pick up the phone to the people, the clever people that you'd like to work with in the future. You have to have, there's some drive. There's a lot of drive there as well.
There is drive. I think that's absolutely fair. There is drive, and I'm probably still very competitive and want the company to be the best company in the world and the most successful company in the world, all of which it won't be, because there'll always be somebody better and bigger. But it isn't really about ego. It's odd, I think, that it isn't about... It's not the reflecting back.
Yeah.
I think it's about, I would like to be 95 and still excited by it.
Yeah.
I'd like it still to be possible that I can be useful to some of it. So actually, in order to do that, I've got to keep building. You know, I can't stop now. I can't just sit back and go, well, that was easy. That was great. I had a really good time and people think I'm awfully special. And anyway, I know as well as you know that the luck of those jobs, the privilege of those jobs is that, of course, it's how you behave in them. But in the end, they're powerful.
Yeah.
So it's how you use that power, and you can use them actually for good and bad, and you can use them to build your own status in some strange way. I'm not really interested in that. I'm just interested in being interesting to my great-grandchildren, actually.
And like all people, all successful people, you never want to retire, it sounds.
No,
is that
I
right?
really don't
no,
want to.
No, I
really
tell.
Don't want to. So I've got to build something that allows me to keep doing it.
Well, Tessa Ross, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on House. Long may it continue. Long may it rain.
Thank you very much.
My thanks then to Tessa Ross. The Big Interview is produced by Gaia Lutz and edited by Cassie Galpin. And from me, Robert Bounds, thanks for tuning in.